my little recorder is now on. You just missed, anybody listening to the recording, just missed the first 2 minutes of this, but that's not a catastrophe. All right, so what kinds of contracts ought to be enforced or will be enforced? Do we just say whatever they agree to will enforce? If not, what are the limits? But then there's a second point, which I remember my father used to describe as there's never enough six-point type in the world, small print. So therefore, any contract is going to have holes in it, in the sense that there will be contingencies that the parties didn't anticipate or thought were so unlikely they weren't worth covering. Then those contingencies happen. If you go to a court, how does the court fill in the blanks? Third question is, how do you prevent opportunistic breach? And what I mean by opportunistic breach is a breach which occurs not because the two parties together are better off as a result of the breach, but because breaching at this particular situation in time lets one party gain the greater expense of the other party. So you might prevent opportunistic breach by how you design the contract, by trying to set it up so there never is a time when one party benefits by walking out of it, and contracts are designed that way to some extent. You might do it by reputational enforcement, by ways of making sure that if I double-cross you on the contract, other people hear about it, that makes me worse off because they won't trust me, therefore I won't double-cross you. Or you might do it in the way that the law schools mostly deal with, by having legal penalties for breach of contract. But at the same time we want to prevent opportunistic breach, we want to permit efficient breach. So there are going to be cases where circumstances change, such that fulfilling the contract makes the two of us on net worse off, and we want to have a contract design, legal regime, whatever we're using, such that efficient breach can happen, opportunistic breach doesn't happen. Any questions so far? This is sort of overview at this level of what we're going to be doing. So let's start with designing contracts. And the basic argument is a very simple argument, which is that we have a common interest in maximizing the size of the pie, and we can then argue over dividing it. And economics doesn't tell us very much about that latter stage, unfortunately. And the reason we have the common interest is that any change that increases total benefits can be combined with an appropriate change of other contractual terms in order to increase benefits for both parties. This is a point which was missed by, I suppose, the most distinguished single figure in my field, namely Judge Posner. Posner wrote a whole book called, I think, Sex and Reason, which was largely about issues having to do with AIDS and related matters, and which produced some strikingly counterintuitive results that were wrong. And the reason they were wrong was that at the core of his model was the assumption that when a pair of people were deciding whether to use protected or unprotected sex, they would use unprotected sex only if both parties preferred it. But of course, as any economist should see, that's the wrong answer. If one party greatly prefers it and the other party slightly doesn't, then in any such relationship, there are a whole bunch of other terms. Who gets to decide what we have for dinner, you know, whatever things, other things matter to the parties, so that you can make side payments and the party who greatly prefers something can, in effect, offer a deal to the other one. That was in a particular, very intimate context, but the basic logic is exactly the same as in an ordinary contract. It's stuff that I am sure Posner has taught in the context of ordinary contracts, but that he missed when he was trying to model that particular piece of behavior. And so in any case, the basic point, though, is that it makes sense to think of the parties as both parties looking for changes that increase the size of the pie, where each party essentially says, if it increases the size of the pie but hurts me, I'll do it, but only if you agree to alter something else to benefit me. So how do we change the size of the pie when we're making a contract? And we do it basically by affecting the incentives that people face in such a way that as the contract proceeds, as people perform their part of it, it's ideally at each point in my interest to make that choice, take that action, which produces most net benefits by both of us. How do we do that? Well, we've really gone through that already in the first half of the course. How do we deal with externalities? Forget about Coase for a moment. Just take the simple world back to Pigou. What's a very simple description of how we get me to make the right choice if my choice has costs or benefits for other people? In one sentence, you should be able to answer that. How do we make it my interest to make the right choice? I don't have to look at the screen. We've gone through all of this before. What does Pigou tell us? All right, within his limits, he's a useful fellow. What does Pigou tell us about how we make it in the interest of a factory that's considering putting sulfur dioxide into the air to do it only if it's worth doing on net? Put it in the general form. Not just some kind of cost. What cost do we want to assign to them? That's right. What we want to do, the simple sort of Pigouvian rule, which is a useful starting point, is we want to make each party in a situation where if they create a benefit, they get the benefit. If they create a cost, they get the cost. All right? You can't do that perfectly, but to the extent you can do it, now you can just let the individual rationality of the parties guide their decisions. So that's sort of the first approximation. Now, it may turn out that we can't always do that. We can't always set up so that they will do that. If we're in a situation where we say, well, because we haven't been able to do that, he's going to make the wrong choice here, and if wrong choices are recognizable, we can say, well, another term in the contract is you're not allowed to make that wrong choice. And we'll get to real examples later. So you can think of it as sort of the ideal thing is to set it up so I have the right incentive. So I decide what choices to make. If for whatever reason we can't get that result, then perhaps we constrain the contract includes limits for each party on what choices they can make. So our ability to do this are limited by at least three different considerations. One of them is what people know. So that I'm hiring you to build a house for me, and to get a little ahead of ourselves, we'll imagine we do it for a fixed price. I say, look, here's how much I'm paying. Why do we do it that way? Because now if you can find a cheaper source for some of your supplies that's just as good, you'll make money by doing it, right? It's money you're saving. Whereas if we did it on a cost-plus basis, you wouldn't care whether it wouldn't be worth your going through the trouble of finding the cheaper source for this particular thing instead of the more expensive. But what's the problem with the fixed cost one? It is that you also have an incentive to cheat on quality. You have an incentive to say, I got these really cheap windows, and not tell me that they are really cheap in both senses of that word. All right, cheap, as you presumably know, has two different meanings in English. One of them is inexpensive, and one of them is low quality. All right. So if I can't tell whether the windows are any good, if I have no way of telling it, then I can't have the contract say, you guarantee to use good quality windows. And if the way I do it is fixed price, the incentives for you are to get the cheapest windows you can, independent of quality, putting aside reputational effects later and such. On the other hand, if I do know, and if I can observe, even though I know a whole lot about insulation, if the situation is that I'm going to be in Europe while you build the house, and by the time I get back, the insulation will all be between two solid walls of cinder block, it doesn't mean it do any good for me to be able to evaluate insulation by looking at it because I can't look at it. All right. So we're constrained by what I can judge, what I know, what I can observe, and what I can control. All right. No, those three things are constraints on what we can do in forming a contract. And it may occur to you that there are also constraints on what we can do with regard to tort law, criminal law, lots of other parts of the law. It's not special to this. And this way of thinking about it applies to all dimensions of the contract. They apply to what happens if one party breaches. First, I've got to know you breached. After all, perhaps the contract was your agreement to recommend me to someone who trusted you for a job. And you agreed to do that in exchange for my doing something for you. I don't get the job, but I don't know if the reason is you didn't recommend me or not. So you might have breached the contract and I can never tell. But in any case, to what extent we can control the outcome of breach depends on what we know, what we can observe, what we can control. It applies to the allocation of risks between the parties. And here our stuff on insurance becomes relevant. In deciding how to allocate the risks to give people the right incentives, we have to worry about moral hazard, that any place where a risk I control is allocated to you, I've got an incentive to take an inefficiently low level of precautions to prevent the risk. right? That's what our insurance stuff told us. But if you think about writing contracts, a lot of what writing contracts are about is if something goes wrong, who pays for it? Well, that's a raises moral hazard issues. It also raises adverse selection issues, that if we have a risk where if something goes wrong, you're going to bear the risk, and neither of us can control it, but I know how big it is, you don't know if you should sign that contract or not. Because you don't know what the chance is of this thing going wrong that you'll pay for. So we might want to have a situation, imagine a case like that. Imagine a case where there is some significant risk. Neither of us can control it, so there's no moral hazard problem. But I know it and you don't. I want to make money out of the contract. So if you say to me, is the risk substantial? I'm like, nah, it's trivial. So sign the contract, we can both make money. But in fact, if you really knew how big the risk was, you wouldn't sign the contract. Because in fact, in my imaginary case, the risk is high enough so that on net we're going to lose money on the contract. But of course, that means you're going to lose money because you're the one who bears the risk. So we might say, all right, you, the guy who knows the risk, should insure me against that risk. We should agree that I should bear that cost, not to avoid moral hazard, but to avoid adverse selection. All right? People see? I'm trying to show how the stuff we did in the first half of the course now starts playing into the design of the contract. And finally, of course, there's risk aversion. We're signing a contract for building a house. This is the only house I'm ever going to have built and buy. You are a contractor who builds with your employees 100 houses a year. Both of us know that things could go wrong. It could turn out that the earth under the foundations isn't as solid as we thought it was, and so it's going to cost a whole bunch more to excavate and put in supports and things. Risk aversion is an argument for which of the two of us bearing that risk, builder or buyer. Anybody? The builder builds 100 houses a year in different places. Buyer is going to buy one house in his lifetime for a large amount of money. Who should bear the risk, as far as risk aversion is concerned, that something will go wrong and makes it much more expensive to build the house?
Buyer.
Why?
I was going to say, when somebody buying one house, they got it's in their interest to really go into
I'm asking about risk aversion. I'm not asking about moral hazard or adverse selection. In terms of risk aversion, the builder can spread the risk over many houses. The risk for any one house is a small share of his income. The buyer has only one house. If it turns out to cost an extra $100,000, his lifetime income just dropped $100,000. So therefore, risk aversion in that case is an argument for the builder bearing it. But you could imagine other arguments that might go the other way. So the point I'm trying to make is that in designing a contract, part of what you're doing is allocating risk, and we already know what are the relevant considerations in allocating risk, and we have to look at the particular case and see how those considerations apply. So if we think about some of the ways contracts can be written, one possibility is fixed price, one is cost plus. Fixed price for building your house gives the contractor an incentive to keep down costs, which is a good thing, but it also gives them an incentive to reduce quality if you can get away with it. Notice that keeping down costs here, part of the reason why you want to do it by his incentives, is that not all the costs are money. So suppose we find out afterwards that if he only spent 3 days searching, he could have gotten his windows for $50 less. Would it have been efficient for him to do so? No, unless his time is very cheap, 3 days costs more than $50, so the right decision is not to. So what you want to do is to not say he's legally obliged to use the cheapest windows he can find. What you want to do is to set it up so that if he can save more money than costs him in time, it'll be an interest to do that. If he can't, it won't. And that's what we would do with a fixed cost contract. That's the advantage of the fixed cost contract. But the disadvantage, as I say, is that he also has an incentive to save money in ways that hurt you by cutting quality. So if you imagine it's a contract for something where it's easy to define the quality we're asking for, then it would make sense to do it on a fixed price basis. I actually had a midterm exam question on my other course in which I was imagining the law school hiring a firm to give bar prep courses to the students. And in the case, I assume that what the law school wants is to maximize its bar passage rate. That's an observable. We know what the bar passage rate is, assuming the law school doesn't care if the students are happy or miserable or, you know, any of that stuff. All they care about is bar passage rate. Then you could imagine they're saying to the bar prep people, all right, we'll pay you X dollars a year times the percentage of our graduating class who passed the first time bar. And that would be a simple way of measuring. Or you could just say, we'll pay you X dollars per year if more than a certain percentage pass. You could imagine different possible contracts. My point is only that you don't have to worry about their skimping on quality if you can measure your output, which in that case, maybe you can, maybe not. Maybe if they get you to pass the bar by flogging you if you don't show up for your lessons, that might have negative effects on the admissions next year, which would be independent from bar passage rate. So next question. So the first question is, in all of the dimensions of the contract, try to set it up to give people the right incentives. Second question is what contracts ought to be enforced. And then the first issue is, should you simply enforce all contracts? And I think there are a couple, the first answer, the one which I think is the weakest one, though it may describe what's happening, is the court may have its own preferences. The court may say, we believe you ought to deal in this fashion rather than that fashion, whether or not you want to. And I think it's generally hard to think of good reasons for doing that, but maybe you could. Second, even if the court doesn't want to impose its preferences, it's got to decide whether or not there's a contract. All right. One of the examples I think that Posner gives, which is probably not a real case, but a real category of cases you may have come into, is my rich uncle on Christmas. He's been drinking a little bit. He's feeling good. And he says to me, kid, if you can get into Harvard, I'll pay for it. And I go to a lot of effort over the next year to make myself able to get into Harvard. And Harvard accepts me, but in this hypothetical, they don't give me a scholarship, full scholarship. And I go back to my rich uncle and I say, you know, here's the bill, uncle, for the first semester. He says, bill for what? I said, for Harvard. He says, ah, you thought I meant it? Do I have a case against him? Should I be able to sue him for adverse reliance, for the fact that I did things to get into Harvard believing he would do this? Or do we say, no, that is not sufficient to make a contract? So that's one out of many other examples. I'll discuss one or two others later, where the court has to decide whether there is a contract and what the contract says, because English language is somewhat ambiguous, and we have to have some way of deciding what the meaning is of the words that we agreed to. And finally, as I was saying earlier, no contract is really complete, because the world is complicated enough so that you never completely describe all the contingencies, or at least I can't think of any where you do, and therefore the court has to fill in the blanks. Questions, comments, clear? So then what's the argument in favor of freedom of contract, in favor of just enforcing all contracts as written? The argument is, well, the parties want an efficient contract. That sounds like a good thing. If the courts say, well, yes, all right, we'll enforce what you wrote, but any time where it's unclear, we're going to read what we think you should have written instead of what you did write. The more they do that, the more people have to spend time and effort writing more and more precise and detailed contracts, covering all of the low probability outcomes. So that suggests that the optimal policy for the court is simply to say, enforce what they agreed to, and if they didn't specify, figure out what they would have agreed to. And that way, they don't have to fill in all the blanks. They can trust the court to fill in any blanks they left out correctly at the end. So that's the basic argument for a very simple version of contract interpretation. Read the contract, do your best to enforce it as written. If there are things that are unclear, enforce what you believe the parties would have agreed to. Question? What's the case against freedom of contract? And there are a number of cases, some of which are stronger than others. Let me start with the first one, which turns out to be weaker than it appears. And that's the monopoly case, where people say, well, yes, this is all very well for a free contract between equals, but they are the only seller of telephone services, so why should we expect them to bother to write efficient contracts? Why won't they just make every term in the contract favorable to them and unfavorable to you? Can anybody say why they will not, in fact, make every term, why they, as rational profit maximizers, won't make every term in the contract as favorable to them as they can?
Because if they did that, people would be incentivized to create rivals for monopoly.
That would be one thing, or not to buy. The fact they have a monopoly doesn't mean you have to buy from them. It just means you can't buy from anybody else. Let's put it differently. One of the terms in the contract is the price. Why isn't it $1 million? After all, if they can set any terms they like, why, in fact, is it not only not $1 million, why, for this particular imaginary monopoly, is the price exactly $17.23? If a stockholder went to the CEO of the monopoly firm and says, you've got a monopoly on widgets, you're charging your customers $17.23, why don't you make it $20 and make us some more money? What would the CEO answer?
They're charging the price at which it's the supply meets demand. They're charging,
it isn't supply versus demand. There is, in fact, no supply curve for a monopoly, only for a competitive industry. It's the price at which he believes he maximizes his profits, because as he raises price above that, he loses more from people buying less than he gains when they're paying a higher price.
Essentially price times customers, right? Because
minus cost of production. Notice that it may cost them something to produce their output. So what the CEO wants to say is, for each additional dollar we sell, how much money do we make? And that's price minus cost. When I raise my price a little bit, I make more money on the extra money people pay on what they're buying than I lose on the lost profits on the stuff they no longer will buy, then I should raise the price, otherwise not. All right? That's a standard monopoly. This is sort of standard economics text. But the point I'm making is only the fact that he has a monopoly doesn't mean he can do whatever he wants, because people can still choose not to buy. So let's carry it further. It's $17.23, and so the stockholder says, well, all right, you can't charge more than that. But I observe that you have agreed that if the product is defective, you'll replace it. Why don't you just wipe out that term on the contract? It'll save us some money. And what does the CEO answer? Why should they have any term in the contract which costs them a penny? We've got a monopoly on cars. Why should we bother to include tires with them? Save some money if we don't.
People aren't going to buy the product if it's not functional.
More precisely, they won't pay the higher price for the product. They could buy the car and buy the tires somewhere else. But if the price at which you maximized your profit was $20,000 for a car with tires, car without tires, many fewer people will pay $20,000 because they know they're going to have to buy the tires as well. All right. So if you think about the logic of the situation on each dimension of the product, even the monopolist is saying, if I change it, will it benefit the customer by more than it costs me? If it will, then I can change it and raise my price. All right? So I say, if I agree to replace defective products, that makes the product more valuable to them. The result is that instead of getting $17.23, I can get $18.23 for it. If it costs us on average less than a dollar per unit to fulfill that guarantee, because we don't make many defective widgets, we make very good widgets, let me tell you, then I'm going to make more money by including that guarantee than not including it. Is the logic of that clear? Because if you think about it, the monopolist in general, even though he's writing the contract and there are no competitors, he still wants to make the terms of the contract adjusted any place where doing that will benefit the customer more than it costs him, because he can then raise the price by the benefit of the customer. Now, there is one important way in which I'm oversimplifying it, and that's that the monopolist only cares about marginal customers. Let's go back to my $18.23 widget. It turns out that there are widget enthusiasts. There are people for whom widgets are really important. They'd buy them for $50. Why does he charge $18.23? Because there aren't enough of those people, and in order to make money, he's got to also sell them to the regular people who may or may not buy them between $18 and $19. Suppose there was a change in the characteristics of the widget, whether a guarantee or anything else, which only mattered to widget enthusiasts. He has no incentive to make that improvement, because the widget enthusiasts are going to buy it at his price anyway. All right? If he can make it less good for the enthusiast without affecting the marginal buyers, so the enthusiast will only pay $49 instead of $50, that's all right. He's only charging them $18.23, so therefore it doesn't affect how many he sells to them. So it turns out, if you work through the logic, that an ordinary monopolist makes characteristics of the product that are efficient vis-a-vis the marginal consumer. The consumer is sort of on the edge of buying or not buying, but not necessarily vis-a-vis all the consumers. And the result might be a higher than optimal quality, a lower than optimal quality, you can't say in general. Somewhat technical point, but I thought it was worth making because I try to avoid saying things that aren't true. And my first point is that the usual arguments do apply to monopolies, and I'm now trying to show that they don't always apply or don't apply perfectly to monopolies. People are looking sort of puzzled. Should I? Do people understand what I was saying or not? Yeah? All right? All right, second one, which is sort of tends to be related to unequal bargaining power, although I think it's used more broadly, is to say, well, the court shouldn't enforce this contract. The only reason you agreed they could repossess the furniture if you didn't make payments was unequal bargaining power. That they were a big, rich company selling lots of furniture. You're a poor consumer. Again, the argument I just made says that doesn't lead to inefficient contracts. If they're in a really strong position, if you really want what they got and there aren't many other people providing it, maybe they can get a high price out of you. But again, it's in their interest to write an efficient contract while at the same time, if they're lucky, getting a high price from you for doing it. And courts are not very well situated to redistribute income. If they say you've got to make the terms more favorable to the poor guy here, all right, more expensive for the seller, more valuable to the poor guy, seller raises his price. But let me take the case which it seems to me gives you the most persuasive argument against freedom of contract and sort of encapsulates a lot of the intuitions about bargaining power, even though I think it greatly exaggerates the real world case. And that's the case where I'm lost in the desert and dying of thirst. And I come across you and you've got this big, big tank of water. And I say, I'd like some of the water. And you say, sure, I'll be glad to sell you some water. How much money do you have? And I reach out, and I've only got $20 on you. Can I have enough water to get back to civilization? You mind pointing me the right direction, by the way? He said, well, $20 isn't very, this is really valuable water to you at the moment. How about writing me a check? I said, well, yeah, I got a checkbook, and I got $600 in my checking account. It's crazy. I shouldn't be doing this, but I'll pay you $600 for enough water to save my life. He said, well, that's a pretty good deal, but I think I can do better than that. I got this contract. And this contract says that for the rest of your life, you will pay me all of your income above what it takes to feed and house you, defined in the contract of the following veg, in exchange for the glass of water and the instructions to get back. And that's a case where I really am worse off because of freedom of contract. And the reason I'm worse off is that you are, in effect, going to get the highest price out of me you can, and unlimited freedom of contract raises the highest price I can pay. And usually I'd like to raise the highest price I can pay. It makes it easier to get stuff. But in this particular case, as I'm not getting any more for the higher price than the lower price, I'd rather have my hands tied. I'd rather be unable to pledge my future income. Argument makes sense? So that is, in fact, an exception. We'll come back to it later because it turns out to be a sort of an interesting exception in terms of economic efficiency because, as I'm going to show, I hope, a little bit later, there is one sense in which all the money for the rest of my life really is the right price for that water, and a different sense in which it isn't. We're giving different people incentives on different margins, and sometimes we can't give everybody the right incentive. Let me go next to the case of real duress, by which I mean the mugger or the equivalent, your money or your life, should we enforce those contracts, and then to what I think of as less real duress. And that's the case where my ship is going down due to having been injured in a storm. Here comes a tugboat. The tugboat says, want a tug? And I say, sure. And the tugboat captain looks at the ship and it looks to me like a $3 million ship. Give you a tug for $2 million. Should we enforce that contract? Right. Let me go to the real duress case for a moment, because that's actually quite an interesting case because the answers are less clear than they at first seem. And I want to start with my standard example. Mugger finds you in a dark alley, puts out a knife, pulls out his switchblade, puts it against your throat, and says, I want $100. I need it for my next shot of heroin. And you say, I'm sorry, but here's my wallet. There's only $30 in it. It's all right. I'll take a check. you write him a check for $100. You know, it's a low price for your life. You go home. He goes to the bank to cash the check. Should you be allowed to stop payment? That's a question of enforceability. That's a case where the contract was made under duress, absolutely clear, unambiguous duress. Our normal standard legal rule is contracts made under duress are not enforceable. Is that a good rule? What's the obvious argument for saying it's not a bad rule? Let us assume that muggers know the law too. At the point when he's got the knife at your throat and is saying, I need $100 for a shot of heroin and I'll kill you if I can't get it, what is your feeling about whether or not you should be able to stop payment on such a check? You don't want to be able to, because if you're able to and he knows it, you can't pay him the $100, so he's going to take your $30, knife you, and go on looking for another victim. Right. Is it nonetheless a good thing that you can stop payment on the check? What's the argument against being willing to enforce that contract? That's right. That if you can make an enforceable contract of that sort, the payoff to mugging becomes much larger because most people have much more money in their checking accounts than in their wallets. Therefore, even though at that particular instance you gain by having been able to make an enforceable contract, very likely the instance wouldn't have even happened if it hadn't been for a law that made the contract enforceable. I want to argue, I didn't realize I had it set up, so I was waiting to give you this slide. I forgot that I had done it this way, so I could do it bit by bit. So, $100 if I'll kill you, will you take a check? I like that. Should I be able to stop payment? There's the trade-off we just discussed. But I want to argue that, in fact, in the general case, because we're asking not just about muggers, but about contracts made under duress, in the general case, it isn't clear. Because what we've really said is there is a gain for making it enforceable. Namely, it's possible to prevent a particular bad thing in this case and a loss. And I want to give you a real-world case where it's at least arguable that making contracts made under duress enforceable makes the world a better place rather than a worse case. And that's the case of General Pinochet in Chile. Right? Pinochet is a Chilean general. As a result of sequence of events which different people have different accounts of, he ends up as the military dictator of Chile. And he's military dictator of Chile for a while, during which various people who he probably doesn't like get killed. And it's at least plausible that that involved a sequence of illegal acts. He then at some point says to the Chilean, the legislature or somebody, look, I got a deal for you. I think democracy is a fine thing. We've solved the problems that made it absolutely necessary for me to seize power temporarily. The communists are not going to take over Chile anymore. I would like to give up power and to return Chile to democracy. But I've got this one problem. I don't want to get hanged. And I don't want my friends to get hanged either. And I am afraid that if I simply give up my power and turn everything back over to the legislature and a new elected president, that after a while, they are going to start charging me and a bunch of, secret police types and military types who worked for me with various crimes, which maybe we committed, maybe we didn't commit. We're going to be a little bit ambiguous on that subject. And we don't like that. So our deal is we will reestablish democratic government if you will give us an amnesty. If you will agree that none of us can be prosecuted for any of the stuff we did while we were in power. And whoever the relevant people were, my guess is it was the legislature, but I didn't follow it, agreed to this deal. And, amazingly enough, Pinochet handed over power. So it was a fairly unusual case. We had a dictator. He was not facing a successful revolution. He peacefully restores democracy. Great thing. Now time passes, and eventually people start taking legal moves to try to charge Pinochet with various crimes. And I think this starts out with a Spanish prosecutor. And I think the claim was that some Spanish citizens had gotten killed in the course of all this. I don't remember the details. And the question is, whatever the legal regimes are that are affecting this, should they recognize that amnesty? The amnesty was surely a contract signed under duress, saying I will remain military dictator. And by the way, I am a military dictator. People occasionally disappear and are never seen again. Can't say why, but might want to consider the matter. I'll remain military dictator unless you sound like duress. On the other hand, if you can't make a reasonably enforceable contract of that sort, Pinochet is still dictator, or since by now he's either dead or dying, I think, he will have handed it off to his second-in-command, who will be a military dictator, preserving the dictatorship to make sure that all of them don't end up getting punished for things they did. So that, I think, is a nice case which illustrates the fact that whether contracts should be enforceable under duress is not an open and shut question. That you really have to think about the fact that you're changing people's incentives on two different margins. On the one hand, what one of you might have said, making the amnesty enforceable makes Pinochet, or in the earlier step, more willing to kill people. All right? If he says to himself, I don't want to be a military dictator for the rest of my life. In fact, I think it would be nice if Chile were a democracy if there only weren't those dangerous communists threatening to do terrible things. So if Pinochet says, very likely eventually we'll reestablish democracy, if he doesn't believe the amnesty will be enforceable, that gives him an incentive to be more restrained in what he does to stay in power. But on the other hand, it also gives him an incentive to stay in power. So you really have a trade-off between benefits on two different margins, as it were, and in a theoretical matter, you can't say which is better. Let me offer the two other examples which I give here. One of them is a peace treaty. Yep.
Wouldn't, if he thought that the amnesty wasn't enforceable, then he has no incentive to not kill people because he's never going to be held accountable.
Unless there's some... That isn't quite right, of course. After all, he might fall from power without his consent. People sometimes do. But he also might say, look, if I'm reasonably restrained about killing people, then there won't be enough public sentiment to prosecute me and my people after we turn it over, whereas the more brutal I am about this, the harder it will be to get people to leave us alone. Because obviously it's going to be a complicated political game after he's out of power. Presumably there'll still be quite a lot of voters who supported him. And military dictators aren't, you know, one guy. They're presumably one guy with some, maybe not majority support, but enough support to pull it off. So you don't know. I mean, but I agree that certainly he's... You have the worry that if he can't get out of it, he has an incentive to get more and more tyrannical in order to stay in power. And that certainly could happen. Peace treaty is my second standard example. And that is, we sort of have a feeling that peace treaties are supposed to be enforceable, even though there's no supranational authority to do it. So that if Germany, take the end of World War I, Germany surrenders. And part of the deal, I think a foolish part of the deal ex post, was that Germany was supposed to pay various indemnities to the Allies for the evil things it had done during the war. And I said, that was probably a mistake. But very few people said, well, look, that's obviously not an enforceable agreement, because look, it was made under duress. I mean, they were dropping bombs on them, and they had armies invading their territory. How much more duress can you have than that? We still have a feeling it's a good thing somehow if wars can be ended by agreements that people will have a reason to keep on both sides. So from that standpoint, I should say, I think you can plausibly argue the Allies broke the agreements too, because prior to the German surrender, the Allies stated a set of conditions. I think it was Wilson's 12 points or something, or 39 points. And I think it's fairly clear that the actual surrender terms were not consistent with those points. So you can say both sides, Germans ended up cheating in the sense they didn't pay all the indemnities, and that the Allies maybe cheated before. But the basic point is it makes sense. Finally, I want to take what is the historically very interesting case, which is ways in which parole and ransoming have historically been used. Because prior, I think, to about 1800, in European wars, you have the following situation. We have a battle, and the French capture some British soldiers. And they include some officers. And the French officer says to the British captain he's captured, Monsieur, here is our jail. If you wish, we will confine you in our jail along with your soldiers. However, the inn here is a very nice inn. The wife of the proprietor is a fine cook. I am sure you, as a well-born Englishman, have available a certain amount of money to pay for an inn. If you will give me your parole not to try to escape, I will not lock you up. Parole just means word in French. And what he was asking for was a promise from the prisoner not to try to escape. That sounds to me like a contract made under duress, in that the alternative is being locked up in the jail. However, the prisoner in fact thought that promise was morally binding. Not only did he think it was morally binding, if he gave his parole, escaped, and got back to England and people found out, they'd cut him dead. He's not a gentleman. He violated his parole. And in fact, one of the deals they would sometimes make in this situation is, well, the inn is awfully crowded, and the jail is crowded, and Monsieur probably would really like to see his wife and children again. So if he will give us his parole, not to fight against the French until he has been exchanged for a French officer of equal rank, he can go home. And again, people thought of that as a binding agreement, and assuming his neighbors and friends knew about it, they would think less of him, not more, if as soon as he got back, he rejoined the army. So that's a really interesting case where you have a contract made under duress. People think of it as enforceable, even if it's enforceable mainly through social sanctions. And I think you could at least argue that it was a good thing. What's the bad thing about it? What's analogous to the other cases? What's the negative consequence of being willing to enforce this contract? What does it do? Why might some people say you shouldn't enforce it, we should break this whole system up, and everybody should feel free to violate his parole as soon as he can? Well, what's the advantage of the parole rule? What's the good consequence of this set of customs? What does it do? It reduces the cost of war. Right? It means that some of the adverse consequences of war, such as people spending time locked up in a prison, people spending time as prisoners in foreign countries, are eliminated. And you can have your war. But once you're beaten, you know, just like a game, once you're beaten, you go sit on the sidelines, and we don't have to worry about any further unpleasantness. Sounds like a great thing. What's the disadvantage? In the immortal words of Robert E. Lee, it is well that war should be too horrible, or men would become too fond of it. All right? I know that's an extreme case, but it reduces the cost of war, and thus makes war more likely. So therefore, it's a nice case where you've got the same two margins as before. And part of the point I'm trying to make is that what's neat about economic analysis is how you can take what look like utterly different world situations, Pinochet in Chile, the parole rules of the 18th century, and muggers, and see how the same analysis applies to each, but gives you different answers according to the numbers, according to how large the benefit on one side and the cost on the other side happens to be. All right, so that's real duress. And the economic answer, surprisingly enough, is that we don't know. That there are going to be some categories like the mugger where we clearly don't want to enforce the contract, but there may be other categories such as the prisoner of war parole where we would like to enforce the contract if we could. Let me take the other interesting case, at least interesting to me, which is the sinking ship. And we're going to imagine that there is a ship whose value is $10 million and that the cost to the tug of tugging the ship back into harbor is $100,000. We now have a bilateral monopoly bargain. The tug is the only tug that can save the ship. The ship is the only ship the tug can save. What's the right price? And the answer, oddly enough, is there isn't a right price because we have two different people we're trying to give incentives to. One of them is the tug captain. Any price more than $100,000 gives the tug captain an incentive to tow the tug. Any price less than $10 million gives the ship an incentive to be towed. All right, that's easy. The more interesting question is, what is the tug captain's incentive to be there to do the towing? If you think about a tug captain who's saying, look, I know that from time to time ships founder in a storm. Weather's looking pretty bad. Should I take my tug out and move into the area where it's likely that there will be ships, some of which might be at risk? But recognizing that not only will going out and cruising around looking for sinking ships cost me a lot of fuel, there's always a risk I might sink too, because the whole reason we got this problem is there's a storm going on. The right incentive for the tug captain to take those risks is $10 million. Because the result of the tug captain doing actions which result in one more ship being saved is indeed a $10 million gain. And therefore, in terms of economic efficiency, we would like the tug captain to be out there looking for ships to rescue as long as the cost to him of, on average, finding one more ship is anything less than $10 million. Does that make sense? Right? Yes? No? On the other hand, There's another requirement. In order that he rescue a ship, we have two requirements. One is the tug be out there when the ship be sinking, and the other is the ship be sinking when the tug is out there. But the ship being sinking when the tug is out there depends on decisions made by the ship owner. The ship owner is saying, how willing should we be to send our ships out in a gale? Or to do various other things to modify what our ships are like to make them less likely to sink, to make all the work. What is the social cost, given whatever the tug owner is doing, what is the social cost of one more ship starting to go down when there is a tug nearby? 100,000. So therefore, we will give the ship owner the right incentive. If the cost to him of having his ship get in trouble with a tug nearby is only 100,000, not 10 million. If it's 10 million, the ship owner will be much too cautious. If it's 100,000, the tug owner will be too cautious or too unwilling to go cruising around. So that means that there isn't, at least for a simple one-price contract, there is no correct answer. There is no right price. And nor is there any reason to expect bargaining to get the right price. And indeed, this is really Coasean double causation coming back again from a different direction, because there are two causes. The benefit is we save a sinking ship. And it's sort of odd to say, how do we make this benefit possible? We put our ship out somewhere where it'll sink. And yet that is indeed a requirement to get the benefit. So the two causes of a tug saving a sinking ship is the ship owner having done stuff that results in there being a sinking ship there, and the tug owner having done stuff that results in there being a tug there. Just as any of our standard Coasean case, if you put all the cost on one party, or all the benefit on one party in this case, of the conjunction, you give him the right incentive and the other party the wrong incentive. So we're really back here that the gain is jointly produced by the ship owner's risk and the tug's expenditures being there to save. So what that suggests, just as in stuff we've talked about before, is what you really would like to do is to put the incentive wherever it does the most good, which means that if the tugs won't be out there unless they get at least $7 million, by God, make it a $7 million or $8 million payment. On the other hand, if the ships if the ships will be way too cautious at 7 million, then push it back down towards 100,000. So you'd really have to know something about the elasticity of supply of sinking ships on the one hand and tugs to rescue them on the other in order to figure out what the optimal price was between those two boundaries. And there's no particular reason for freedom of contract to give the right answer. And there's a real problem with freedom of contract. What's the problem? Suppose we take a strict freedom of contract deal, which is whatever price the tug captain and the ship captain agree to, that's the price the ship owner has to pay. What's the obvious problem with that? Well, he's going to pay then. Whether it's duress is a little unclear, because unlike all other cases, the tug captain didn't make the ship sink. All right, so it's not as if it's his fault. Envision the scene. All right, here's the sinking ship, here's the tug, and we've got a bargain on the price. What are you worried about? That's right, because each party, it's a bilateral monopoly bargain, and the ship captain is going to stand there bravely on his sinking ship saying, $150,000 and not a penny more. And the tug captain is going to say, Captain, have you noticed what's rising up around your ankles? $8 million and not a penny less. So it's a particular case where the nature of the contract is likely to make bargaining costs potentially fairly high, because they may misjudge things and the ship go down. Very much like the argument of getting against the strikes, all right? If you think about what are the problems with the strike, it's that the two parties are creating real costs in the process of their bargaining. And that suggests that maybe the right rule, which I think is the rule you have, is the tug rescues the ship, and then there is a admiralty court proceeding in which neutral parties say what's a reasonable price. How they decide it, I don't know. Now, I can't neglect mentioning, with regard to the question of whether it's the tug's fault that the ship is down, there is a short story somewhere, and I think it's by Rudyard Kipling, where you've got a shipping line where the owner is a very sort of not very nice and rather stingy guy. And his engineer has told him over and over again, you know, this ship has got really serious problems which are going to, you know, cause a catastrophe. Eventually, he refuses to listen because it would be expensive to fix it. Eventually, the engineer, I think, quits, goes to another ship owner who is stingy but competent. That is, he's a skinflint, but he does his job and doesn't like the first one, and arranges to have one of his ships more or less shadowing the first ship at the point when it starts to go down, at which point, under the existing law, they tow it in and basically get the ship or some large part of its value. So that's a case where, in a certain sense, it was deliberate, but it's a somewhat special case. Anyway. All right. So in a fully Coasean world, by which I mean a world of zero transaction cost, we could actually optimize on both margins. Because in that world, odd though it may seem, the tug would pay the ship to take risks. The tug would say to the ship, look, I'm going to observe how often you go out on stormy nights, and we will pay you more money to go out more on stormy nights. And the ship will say to the tug, look, we will observe how often you're around places where we might sink, and we'll pay you to be around. And then we could do all our bargaining before the ships are actually sinking. And agree essentially, just as in any other contract case, each of us will behave in the optimal, efficient manner, and we'll agree on some division of payment between us. But in a real world, it would be very hard to arrange that. So that suggests a research project. If any of you ever want to be professors of economics,
will they do boat-tug insurance, where you pay a certain amount per month
uh-huh.
to get either flat rate or free?
That's interesting.
So usually there are sort of coastal agreements where, like, you every marina on the West Coast has a tug that, you know, at least adheres to this contract.
So part of the contract is insurance. So in effect, part of the contract is the tug agrees, as it were, to be cruising around a certain amount, to have some level of availability.
Right.
Yes. So that's very interesting. That was my project, basically, was to look at the whole market and see. Because quite often, problems that economic theorists see as insoluble, someone in the market has solved 50 years earlier. So in this case, you have an insurance company which is insuring the ship.
Right.
Is that right? And the insurance company has a contract with the tug?
Yeah.
And that contract specifies in some form the obligations of the tug and what the tug will get. Is the tug only getting a monthly fee, or is it also getting money when it saves ships?
That I don't know.
All right. Yep.
I only know it from the boat owner sign. You
right.
pay a certain amount per month, and it's usually either, you know, just like a car would be, where it, you know, tows only $50 when it could be really expensive, or
right.
I think it's usually if you're within a certain range of your harbor, it's free.
Right.
And then if you're outside of the range of your harbor and you want to get towed to another
right.
harbor, then pay a set amount per distance.
Very interesting. Thank you. Interesting information. Right. Anyway, I was saying, it would be interesting to look at the degree to which pre-contracting, and you're giving an example where it does, deals with this. What size boat are you talking about?
The only experience I have is sailboats. So 25.
So small.
25.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean.
Yep. So I wonder what the equivalent is on the sort of commercial market for ships that really are multi-million dollar ships.
I would presume they would have a similar arrangement, but...
Might be. Don't know. Be interesting to know. Anyway, thank you. Let's go back to the water in the desert. If you think about the two margins, one of them is my willingness to take the risk of being stranded in the desert dying of thirst, and the other is your willingness to spend your time sitting in the desert with a tank of water waiting for somebody to wander in whose life you can save. On your margin, we want the payment to be the value of my life. That's the benefit you're producing by being there. All right. On my margin, since when I do take a risk and get lost in the desert, I'm not imposing a $300,000 whatever it is cost on you. We want the price to be the much lower price that reflects the cost to you of my actually using your water. So it's in fact an analogous case if you really work through the economics of it, which again, to me is fun. All right. Let's go on to something else, which some people think of as involving some sort of duress, which I want to argue isn't, what I refer to as bogus duress. The sinking tugboat is sort of semi-duress. It's duress, but it's the ocean and not the other party that's responsible for it. And contracts of adhesion, which I think comes from a French term, is a fancy name for form contracts, for contracts where I go to hurts, and I don't bargain with them. They just say, here's this thing, take it or leave it, sign it or don't sign it. Maybe you get a check, a couple of boxes for options. And at least some of the discussion of it suggests that because these are not reached by free and fair bargaining between the party, somehow they're not legitimate. And as I've suggested in the monopoly case, which doesn't have to be what's going on here, in fact, Hertz doesn't have a monopoly, it's not very close to a monopoly. In practice, there are, what, about six or eight companies, I think? Maybe not that many now. I think at least two of them merged a couple of years ago. But nonetheless, I think all of them use form contracts. And as in the argument I was making before, it's in their interest to try to design the terms of the contracts in ways that fit the desires of their customers, subject to the cost to them, of course, because the more they give their customers what they want, the higher the price the customers will pay for their service. The particular one, which I know my wife is always complaining about, some of them do and some of them don't, is the question of whether it costs extra for both of us to be able to drive the car when we're renting around the car. And her argument, which seems like a pretty good argument, is, look, why would we would want both of us to be able to drive? Because sometimes one of us is tired. Don't they? Do they want somebody who's tired to be driving their car and smashing it into something? No, they don't. So they ought not to charge for that. It doesn't cost them anything. I don't know what their counter-argument is. Maybe that we'll drive it more if two of us can drive it.
But I thought maybe it's only Hertz. I know a few of them had done it. So now if you live in the same residence, then you don't need to pay. But if it's you and someone doesn't live in the same residence, then you have to.
That particular rule I haven't seen. My impression had just been that it depended on the company and maybe even the city for reasons I don't know. But I think there are cases where if you ask the company, they say, well, it'll depend on which outlet it is. But we certainly, when we're traveling together, try to get one that will, because my wife is a safer driver than I am. But we want me to be able to drive if she's tired or if I'm going somewhere without her briefly or something of that sort. Let me suggest that underlying these questions, there are really three different models of how you control, of how you get organizations to do the right thing. And one model, which I think gets a much better press than it deserves, is democracy. So democracy is majority vote. A second model is what really comes down to fighting, even though it's not always put that way, and that's the idea of the bargaining process, for example, as I won't do this unless, well, I will, sort of a tug of war, although it's done without violence, and the ultimate sanction is just I won't sign, but nonetheless it's seen as I'm pushing my interests, you're pushing your interests. And then the third alternative is an ordinary market. And I want to argue that the market alternative can reasonably be described as competitive dictatorship. And that of all of the known forms of government, competitive dictatorship, when it's an option, is far and away the best. Because competitive dictatorship is how hotels are run, and hotels are run much better than countries or states are run. It's how restaurants are run, that I have a favorite Japanese restaurant. You might even argue it has a monopoly, for us at least. For a reasonable payment, can even tell you where it is, on Winchester and what's the cross street? It's a little bit north, whatever is one major street north of Stevens Creek, on the north of the 280. Is it Prune Ridge? Or I'm not sure. I confuse those. I'm very bad on names. But anyway, it's called Yuki Sushi, and it's a very good Japanese restaurant.
Yeah, it's Prune Ridge.
It's Prune Ridge. Anyway, so I recommend it highly. If any of you know a really good Chinese restaurant in this area, I want to know about it, because we have a pretty good, yes?
In Loveland.
I'm not sure that counts as this area. Which one?
It's
Taiwan?
It's like maybe 5 minutes from my house.
What's the restaurant?
I can't think of the name now. It's on the same street as Opa. It's like a little recent restaurant.
Opa's on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I think I've eaten. I think it's called Taiwan, if I remember correctly. But I may be wrong. I think it's one that I went to with somebody.
It's like the only one that I've actually liked around.
All right. If it's the one I think it is, I think I agree it is a good restaurant, but it is not really close to us, although it's not a horrible distance away. Yes. We live, if you think about where the San Tomas runs under 280, we live just a little bit southwest of that, so sort of west San Jose. But anyway, good restaurants are always an important subject of conversation. But in any case, Yuki Sushi, I have no vote at all, right? I don't get to vote on what's on their menu. I don't get to vote on what hours they're open, any of that stuff. I don't even get to argue with them. I mean, I can if I want, but it wouldn't be much point to it. It's not like their menu is the result of a meeting where participatory something or other, where the customers and the proprietor and the waiters all get together and discuss what they should do. No, Yuki Sushi is run by whoever owns it. My guess is that the family is watching it operate. I've been a customer there for many years. They're very nice people, and they make really good food at a reasonable price, and they're open reasonable hours. Why do they do all of that? Because I have an absolute vote on whether I come or not. And I think if you look at it, where that's an option, it's hard to make that work for countries because the cost of moving from one country to another is quite high, although my son, my adult son, is working on a project to deal with that problem. But at the level where it does work in things like hotels and restaurants, just seems to me it's a whole lot better than democracy, bargaining, participatory, this and that, and so forth. And that's what's basically going on with Hertz and Avis, that they're running their companies. I'm not competent to run the company. I don't know how to run the company. All I'm competent to do is say, here are the different companies. These are the terms they're offering. This is my experience about the quality of their products. This is the one I want to go to. Last year, we were doing a good deal of rental car driving because we were driving my daughter around looking at colleges. And we rented from one of them a car, and like for the first hour, I thought it was a Honda because there was this H on it, and it was a really nice car, just about Honda quality. Turned out it was the Hyundai. At that point, I concluded maybe the Koreans had really caught up now. Then we ended up with another one of the same model later, and still equally good as far as I could tell. All right. So anyway, so why do you use form contracts? Most obvious reason is that Hertz is making huge numbers of contracts, and it'd be really expensive to hire a lawyer to negotiate each one. In addition to which, Hertz has to, or Avis in my example here, has to constrain its own employees. If Hertz said to each desk clerk, look, you make a deal with the customer as to how much you'll pay, here are your constraints, they would have to worry a good deal about their customers improving their income by having arrangements. Not their customers, their employees, by having the arrangement with favorite customers, slip me $5 on the side and I'll give you the lowest price that I'm allowed to give you. And why shouldn't you use form contracts given that the standard argument for efficient terms still hold? Now, if we accept freedom of contract for a moment, I guess later on, there's another argument against freedom of contract, but I think I think it's in a later slide. If not, I'll come back to it. But the other argument against freedom of contract is the one I hinted at the beginning, that sometimes the contract affects people other than the two parties, and so we may want to restrict in those cases. But if we accept freedom of contract, then the problem of interpreting contracts is identical to the problem of designing them. That we design contracts by figuring out what terms maximize the sum gains to the parties. Write those in if you're writing a contract, add them if you're a court filling in blanks. So that if you think about any risk allocation question, you look at who can best prevent the risk, that's moral hazard, who best knows that that's adverse selection, who can best spread the risk, that's risk aversion, make some attempt to estimate how important those different issues are in this particular case, and then assign the risk to the party when you're designing the contract, to the party who on net you get the best result from assigning it to, the least inefficiency, and do the same thing if you're a court and have to assign it. Let me take a favorite imaginary example of mine, and that's I spend $100,000 doing a superb photography run in the Himalayas. I'm going to make a coffee table book out of it. I come back, I drop off my film at Walmart, and when I get it, it's all blank. Except for a few pictures of somebody's baby who they got in by mistake. Should they be liable for $100,000? And I think the answer in this case is it is true that making them liable for $100,000 would give them an incentive to take the right level of precaution with my film. But it would also, since they don't know this is a $100,000 roll of film, give them an incentive to actually to take a lower level with mine, because it's only the probability of it being this, and to raise the level of precaution they take on everybody else's film, where it's not worth spending an extra few dollars to make it absolutely sure that nothing goes wrong with it. All right? What we run is not incentives, it's the right incentive. It's a Coasean problem. And what's the other way of preventing the problem? One way is having Walmart treat every roll of film as if it's worth a fortune. What's the other way of preventing the problem? You don't send it to Walmart, right? The Himalayan photographer goes to some specialist who charges a higher price, and in exchange for that is much, much more careful with how they handle your film. We now get to more reasons not to enforce. And here, think about third-party effects. What the parties are maximizing is their summed gain. They don't count effects on other people. So, for example, we don't enforce performance contracts for assassins. If I hire you to kill him, and you take the money and don't execute the contract, and I sue you and ask for my money back, the court will not, in fact, make you give my money back. They may do other things, but they won't make you give my money back. Why? Because while my hiring you to kill him indeed maximized the net gain for us, because we will imagine the woman I wanted to marry had been looking favorably at him, and I want to get him out of the picture, and I got lots of money, and you like killing people for money. On the other hand, if we include his welfare, it's not efficient, then we want to take account of that. Similarly, contracts not to testify in court are usually not enforceable. What's the striking exception to that? How can I get somebody to be legally contracted not to testify against me in court?
FDA agreement, right?
What? What?
Like a government agreement with the government?
Huh. I don't know. I was thinking about marrying somebody. Now, I'm not sure. Can a wife testify against her husband if she wants to? She can't be required to. Is she allowed to or not?
You can testify against, but you can't. The communications are privileged regardless, so she can't testify as to what he said.
I see. So to some degree, you could, in effect, contractually limit.
She can testify against what he did, but she cannot testify.
That's very interesting.
Testify against what he said.
All right. Great. But in any case, to some extent, it lets you restrict it. But in general, you can't enforce typically those. And in the U.S., you can't enforce cartel agreements unless it's a government cartel. That is, the government regulatory agencies often actually function as cartelizing agents. But in an ordinary cartel, we just got six firms in the industry, and they make a deal saying none of us will sell for less than $50 a ton. And if anybody does, he owes a fine to the rest of us. That fine is not enforceable in court in the U.S. at present. In England, in the early 20th century, some such contracts were enforceable. I remember coming across a case that involved one. And the argument there is that the cartel agreement benefits the producers, but only at the expense of the consumers, and therefore we would rather not have it enforceable. The other category is contracts by what the courts think of as irrational parties, parties who can't be trusted to know what's in their own interest. Children have limited abilities to sign enforceable contracts, so do insane people, and for quite a long time, women had limited ability to sign enforceable contracts. And that sort of, I like that example because it makes the point that the same legal rule from one side can be seen as a way of protecting people and from another way of restricting people. That in one sense you can say, well, look, here is this poor woman who knew nothing about the world, signed a contract, and now all her property is going to go to this rogue. But the flip side of it is, here is a businesswoman who wants to get started starting her own business. She can't do it because she can't sign any enforceable contracts with anybody. Same legal rule seen from the opposite side. All right, I think that finishes what we're doing. We'll go on to talk about breach next time.